from central government to communities without actually providing the resources and other things that needed to go with that.
It was a victory for the new right in the halls of the Beehive. But I don't think the Ministry of Education realised that.
Over time, limited government funding would force trustees to look for money elsewhere, to charge student fees, to seek corporate sponsorship, to advertise for paying pupils. They'd be forced to compete with one another, and so would kindergartens, polytechs, and universities. In the 1940s, the first Labour government laid the cornerstone of the New Zealand welfare state when it established a free public health service. It was paid for out of taxes and available to all regardless of wealth. In the 1980s, Treasury decided the health service needed urgent restructuring. People should pay for their own health care through private insurance. Vouchers would be given to the poor so they could buy private insurance.
Raywin Poynton, nurse.
I do think that the people of New Zealand were generally satisfied with the health system. But as more and more reports came out saying that it wasn't functioning well, people began to believe that there's no smoke without fire.
Roger Douglas's friend, Alan Gibbs, had been appointed chairman of a three-person task force to recommend changes to hospitals and related services. Assisted by Treasury official Peter Bushnell, the task force met in private, heard few submissions, and reported in April 1988.
I want to emphasise that the central issue in our report is the creation of an internal market in the health system to set prices as a guide and control on management.
The Gibbs report was met with a lot of favour from a lot of people, especially a lot of the big business people.
As far as the hospital side of our business is concerned, I see a longer term possibility of contracting to the public sector, and we're quite excited about this.
When I first read the Gibbs report, I can remember thinking, this is the beginning of the end, because it only presented two options. It presented option A, which was privatisation, the whole lot, and option B, which was contracting out, funder provider split, those sorts of ideas.
Rick Barker, Service Workers Union.
The proposition of having a contractual relationship between the regional health authorities and the providers of health, in my view, puts the system at risk of being handed over slowly but inevitably to private health interests.
Professional and public opposition was widespread. Health Minister David Cagle distanced himself from the task force.
But I believe that it is irresponsible for him to claim and to keep on claiming, for example, that we can eliminate waiting lists. To claim that hospital waiting lists are somehow a symptom of a system that is broken down or that can't cope. To claim that with better management and greater efficiency, waiting lists would disappear. I believe that
I guess it was like a bit of a political hot potato, because it had met with such a lot of general disease that it faded into the background. But it was still there, and it was still casting a shadow over future decisions that were being made in health.
I think in the end that someone will get the structure right, because I think all around the world, government state sector systems that are run like ours, like the British National Health Service, all have a similar structural problem. Our report was apparently a Treasury officer just returned from the United Kingdom, and every person he spoke to over there had a copy of our report. They thought that would be likely the way they would have to go to fix the British system, which has similar problems. So I'm not really dismayed in the long run. I think that for the health of New Zealanders, we're going to have to go that way, and I think sooner or later it's going to happen.
The Business Roundtable lobbied hard to keep the revolution going. They used the level of public debt to justify selling public assets and cutting government services.
Ron Trotter, Chairman of the Business Roundtable.
We've got to get to the other side of the river. We're in the middle of the river now, and we'll drown if we don't do something about it. We just can't go on borrowing, whether we like it or not. We will find the shutters coming down, and we truly can become a third world country unless we pull ourselves together.
And that meant pulling apart the state. The state sector bill dismantled the public service. The public service unions campaigned against the bill.
Helen Kelly, the Early Childhood Workers Union.
The State-Owned Enterprise Act took away the trading elements of the state and put them into their own little enterprises so that they could then be commercialised, sold off, or whatever the government wanted to do with them. And the State Sector Act then broke up the rest of the state from a unified state sector into little groups that they could then be dealt with in any way that the government chose. So instead of having to deal with the whole state sector and make changes that way, they could then look at one particular sector of the state sector and make changes to it.
Each department would be run like a private corporation, controlled by a new chief executive.
That person in turn becomes the employing authority for that particular department and can then flow those kinds of appointments on down through the service. That ought to be of concern not only to public servants but to every citizen in New Zealand. It's a most dangerous bill from a constitutional point of view.
Thousands of public service workers protested in rolling stoppages throughout the country, but the Labour government passed the bill on time and with little change.
Minister, are you proud of this bill?
Yes, I am. It's going to serve the community as a whole and the public service employees very well in the years ahead.
Government departments could be reviewed and restructured and then reviewed and restructured again. Each change would produce redundancies and a move towards private providers and user pays.
It's leading edge, what I would call leading edge kind of work in terms of the privatization, in terms of an honest assessment of what the risks are to government, and in terms of how risks are accounted for. There are just things going on here in New Zealand structurally that simply will not be occurring in most of the world for many, many years.
We are no one-man band.
Order.
And I make no apology for the vigorous debate that has preceded many of this government's reforms. But let no one doubt our unity of purpose, the unity and strength of our commitment to restore the ideals of stability and opportunity which made this country great.
In the second half of 1988, with tension increasing between David Longy and Roger Douglas, public support for the government was plummeting, but the finance ministers pressed on with their programme.
Douglas out!
Roger Douglas sincerely believed that the interests of the lower socio-economic groupings, the unemployed, the people on basic wages, would be better served by continuing the reforms than they would be by backing off them and trying to improve the level of social service delivery. Now, he sincerely believed that, whereas Longy sincerely believed the direct antithesis.
Associate Finance Minister Richard Preble was determined to sell Air New Zealand. The Labour Party hierarchy did not agree.
Ruth Dyson, Labour Party President.
If there is a proposal to lose the majority government shareholding, we'll be putting our case quite strongly that that isn't the commitment that we went to the electorate on, and there would have to be very good reasons for us to then change that commitment.
I would expect that we will make a decision definitely on this side of Christmas.
A decision on who will get 35%?
We'll make a decision on the future of the whole airline.
There was no sign that there was anything improper here. It was just politically very unacceptable to the Labour Party, who in this case backed Longy and said, you know, to Longy, we want this process slowed down and we want to be consultant. So the pressure built up and built up and built up, and Preble in fact did have the majority support of Cabinet. The Prime Minister couldn't slow this process down by using his position as Chairman of Cabinet because the Cabinet itself was going with Preble.
And Richard Preble was going ahead with asset sales. The shipping corporation was next. He again resisted consultation with the Labour Party. On the 4th of November 1988, David Longey sacked Richard Prebble from his post as Minister of State-Owned Enterprises.
My view of these matters is that this is a government and that you cannot have what would be unassailably proper procedures in the private sector being used in a government situation.
With the sacking of Richard Prebble, the conflict between Roger Douglas and David Longey came to a head.
At 1 o'clock today, I received a letter from the Honourable Roger Douglas. That letter began thus: after long and very careful consideration, I have decided to tell Caucus that I can no longer work as Finance Minister in a cabinet led by you. I received that letter. I took it to be a letter of resignation.
You're already in the money. Look, mate, do it. It's a good deal.
These guys have had an initial panic reaction, which is to disinvest. How much further they disinvest is anyone's guess. I think the next 24 hours are going to be crucial. It'll be very interesting to see the way the European market interprets this news and then the way that the American market interprets it after that.
It was impossible for me to continue. I stayed in as long as I thought that I could help confidence in the marketplace. But when events unfold, which you cannot control, then it was simply time for me to go. Interest rates since Richard Prebble's sacking have gone up by well over 1%. That is entirely unnecessary. That is costing people a lot of money, or will, in terms of their mortgages, and it's costing people investment, and it's costing jobs, and that was not something which I could sit by and watch as Minister of Finance.
David Cagle now became Minister of Finance.
I don't see taking over this particular office at this stage as a break in policy, a change in direction in any way. And it seems to me that that is the most important statement that can be made in terms of the markets.
Jim Anderton, Labour Party MP, 1984-89.
I had several meetings with David Longey, trying to convince him that there were alternatives, presenting him some of them, and feeling almost as though at the end he was a captive. In fact, I recall once saying to him, surely you could get support from Helen Clark for this position. He said, the only supporter I have in the cabinet is Russell Marshall. Helen Clark is so dry she's combustible. And at that point it was clear that Longey had no control whatever in the cabinet, and that the new right was now totally in control of the government.
You know, and the pressure of being one person standing against this, even though Prebble and Douglas were out of cabinet, became too much. That was his one flaw as a politician, that he couldn't put together a coalition to back what he was doing. His coalition, in fact, that had got him into office had been Roger Douglas, Richard Prebble and their friends. I mean, those were his mates.
When the Labour Party caucus re-elected Roger Douglas to cabinet, it was too much for David Longey. 7 days later, he resigned.
And I just want to salute you for a great contribution to New Zealand, for a great contribution, in fact, to the world political stage, because you are recognised and known as a leader internationally who has done some exciting things for this country. And I think that's just something that we should all say thank you for. And, my friend, I'm sorry to see you go.
Can I tell you, Geoffrey? I've changed my mind.
New Prime Minister Geoffrey Palmer kept Roger Douglas out of economic policy, but with little chance of re-election, the government continued to implement the new right agenda. Richard Prebble was reappointed and told to sell more state assets.
We're here today to announce the sale of Telecom Corporation of New Zealand and to introduce the partners who will be guiding this company in the future.
The sale to an American-led consortium was opposed by 96% of New Zealanders. Promises safeguarding the community's interests were engraved in stone tablets made of plastic.
I'd like to thank the Treasury and the advisors to Treasury, Butter Wilson and C.S. First Boston.
Today, ladies and gentlemen, I want to share with you National's economic vision. This really is a very proud day for the National Party, and we're just so thrilled that so many of you have made it your business to travel to be here today.
A general election was due in November 1990. The National Party knew it could win.
Michael Laws, National Party MP.
Checkbooks are always open for a political party, so long as they get the get the things right. You know.
The goals by themselves are very specific. 3% growth, we haven't attained it, is very specific. Halving unemployment is very specific. Balancing the budget is very specific.
They were looking for somebody who had an agenda, a plan, an ideology. And of a pretty talentless caucus between 1987 and 1990, there was really only one person on the economic front who had that agenda, and that was Ruth Richardson. And she basically made her ideology the party's, principally because she faced no opposition.
Ruth Richardson had the help of two economists, Martin Haymes from the National Bank and Ian Rennie from Treasury.
There's no question that the paid advisors that were put into the opposition, one by Treasury and the other by the commercial community, had a significant influence in fleshing out the ideology of Ruth Richardson and turning it into practical policies that could be implemented if National gained power.
National began the 1990 election campaign with the slogan, "Creating a Decent Society," and presented itself as defending the New Zealand way of life.
What about your overtime rates, your penal rates?
Good question.
Jim Bolger, National Party leader.
We are not changing overtime rates or penal rates. That's a Labour lie. And they had to take their advertisement off radio yesterday because of the lie.
The plans being made by Ruth Richardson and Treasury hardly featured in National's campaign promises.
Yeah, that's my bit. Yeah, that's my bit.
Treasury officials again prepared a brief for their next Minister of Finance. They recommended shifting health, education and welfare costs onto families and individuals, reducing corporate taxes, cutting benefits and wages, and encouraging foreign investment in this country.
Then you'll be able.
Meanwhile, Jim Bolger was promising tougher controls on foreign ownership, abolition of the superannuation surtax, and no cuts in health and education spending.
Can you give a cast-iron guarantee that they will not be broken, that they will all be implemented?
No, we will honour our promises. The policies we thought through very carefully before we put them into our manifesto, they're there to be honoured and to be put in place.
The 1990 general election offered New Zealanders a choice between National and Labour, now led by Mike Moore. There was no great enthusiasm. Voter turnout was the lowest ever. As expected, National won a huge majority.
But here is Jim Bolger. Look at the media huddle around him. I'm staying well out of that. He's going over to the phone to pick it up. Mike Moore's been waiting for a while.
Thank you, Mike, and as you say, the result has been it's substantial.
Right beside him, as soon as Mike Moore conceded, a couple of Treasury officials had been driven, apparently, on that particular day to Tikawiti to brief the Prime Minister on this crisis that had accompanied or had been brewing in the background away from public gaze. And they came to Jim Bolger on election night and said, "Prime Minister, we've got something we really must urgently tell you." And according to the Prime Ministerial aides, Jim Bolger and the aides said, "You've got to be joking, sport. Now's the time for party. Come and see us tomorrow." And sure enough, there they were, in their suits, a couple of them, in their dossiers, and very early on the Sunday morning they briefed the Prime Minister at his home in Te Puere as to this crisis. That basically the Bank of New Zealand was on the verge of collapse, that there had been a considerable blowout in government spending, absolutely unaccounted for in terms of the budgets. And I can remember the Prime Minister must have obviously been quite shaken by this, this news. Drastic and urgent measures needed to be taken.
That afternoon, Jim Bolger flew back to Wellington. Treasury claimed the crisis was so deep and urgent that only one course of action was possible. Government expenditure had to be slashed across the board.
Now we've got to go away and they tell us there's a little bit of work to do. Thank you very much.
That allowed rapid advancement of the new right agenda. Jim Bolger accepted Treasury's recommendations and appointed Ruth Richardson Minister of Finance.
Roger, will you make sure they all go out, because some of them mightn't pick that they're not the new members.
Michael Laws, National Party MP.
He looked at our manifesto, which was sitting in the front desk of the caucus room, and he pointed at it and he said, and we've got some problems with this as well. And I can remember turning to one of my colleagues to my right and saying, dear God, we're going to rat. We've only been in for 5 days.
Winston Peters, Cabinet Minister, 1990 to 91.
Well, to be fair to the caucus members, the new caucus members in particular, they weren't informed enough. They didn't know enough about what was going on. An enormous amount of trust is required in those circumstances. They played a wait-and-see role, but of course things move so dramatically fast that you're waiting to see developments which don't relate initially to, at the end, to those things that drove them at the beginning. I think it's not critical to say that they were inexperienced, but many were. Those who were experienced were in large measure ignored.
$640 million was lent to the Bank of New Zealand to save it from collapse, and the new government began cutting expenditure.
It's a bit murky like this announcement. On budget night, the table to surplus, that is the government's cash position, was projected to be $4.989 billion in the financial year ended 30 June 1991. Today I am announcing a revised projection of $2.556 billion as a surplus.
Treasury and, I guess, the Reserve Bank scared the incoming Prime Minister and Cabinet into taking precipitate action. And it was action that Ruth Richardson was quite happy to take, after all. Ideologically suited her, and it suited ministers like Upton and Luxton and Williamson again. But there was no question that Bolger and Birch, who were meant to be holding the strings on Richardson, in the same way I guess that somebody walks a dangerous dog on a leash, there was no question that they felt the situation was so urgent that the dog should be unleashed. So it was.
Over the next few weeks, Ruth Richardson and her Treasury advisers told the new ministers about the large cuts they wanted from most government departments.
They wrote, as had become the case, all of the economic advice to all of those other ministers. There is no, after Labour, there was no contestability of advice. Treasury gave the sole advice, and any alternate opinion had to come from outside.
So that would include, say, education?
That's right.
Health, whatever, all social?
The whole lot.
Murray Horn, the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, 1990 to 93.
A lot of people make the claim that Treasury is too powerful. And I think that what they fail to realise is that this is a very contestable business. Everybody has the ear of ministers. from interest groups that are able to pour a lot of money into getting advice from all sources, through to the constituent who writes a letter to the minister. And in that sort of environment, it's the power of the ideas and the analysis that counts. So if governments listen to you, it's because you've got good ideas and you can back it with solid analysis.
Mr. Speaker, the government has prepared tomorrow's announcement in view of the disastrous state of the New Zealand economy which we have inherited. Without exception, all the key indicators on economic health are looking bad.
6 weeks after the election, the government announced its first economic package. Sickness benefits for solo parents were cut by 11%. Widows' benefits were cut by 17%. The dole for adults under 25 was cut by 25%. Charges for doctors' visits and medicines were increased. The public health system would be reviewed, education spending was cut, and further reports commissioned. The welfare state was being redesigned.
Winston Peters, Cabinet Minister, 1990 to 91.
Basically, if you move with enough speed, as they had for that December 19 package, you can get away with it. But what's very clear, though, is that the December 19 package was written long way before the 1990 election. It wasn't prepared after the election. It was probably in full preparation in August, September, before the election.
Unemployed Workers' Union.
People are already struggling to survive, just with the basic necessities of food, going to the doctors, things like that. So those things, which are the necessities which people can't meet now, are going to be put even further out of their reach.
Brian Easton, economist.
Beneficiaries are going to have $1 billion less to spend next year. That's $1 billion less spending in the shops. That's $1 billion less production. That's $1 billion less employment.
Lower benefits were necessary for the next step in the New Right program, reducing labour costs by cutting the pay packets of unskilled, low-paid and young workers.
Jenny Shipley, Minister of Social Welfare, 1990 to 93.
One of the major reasons why this government has had to face up to doing the things that we announced is that we need to create the gap between work and welfare.
The second measure to cut labour costs was announced by the new Minister of Labour, Bill Birch. The Employment Contracts Bill completely rewrote New Zealand's industrial relations law.
It is policy which is developed to suit the situation in New Zealand, and it is the result of several years' work.
It's not in the country's interests to leave that 100-year-old, highly regulated, rigid, legislated for environment in place.
Helen Kelly, Early Childhood Workers Union.
That removed national bargaining structures that were in place at the time. Most workers in the workforce were covered by a document that was negotiated nationally between unions and employers and set down the basic minimums that they were entitled to at work. And that included things, basic things that you would call human rights, I guess, like lunch breaks, tea breaks, health and safety procedures, personal grievance procedures, wage rates, all those sorts of things that workers are generally come to accept as entitlements when they took a job. And it put workers on their own and gave the employer ultimate power to set those wages and conditions.
The extent of the proposed reforms amazed the nation. The words trade union weren't even used in the new law. Employers welcomed the proposals. The bill would enable them to cut wages, abolish overtime and penal rates, and save money by cutting back the working conditions of their employees.
Too many New Zealanders still float in a dreamtime world that has the good life as a matter of right.
Cheap labour would make New Zealand more attractive to international investors. There were rolling strikes, stoppages, rallies and marches throughout the country. Submissions were made to the Select Committee and to government.
There was a huge debate amongst the unions about whether we'd have a general strike, and in the end that was voted against at a CTU conference. My feeling at the time was that we should have organised some sort of public disruption. That sort of thing could have been done and wasn't done, and it wasn't done because we had been weakened under the Labor government and we lacked that really strong leadership and direction.
We want to get into government!
The legislation was passed on schedule. It was even tougher on workers and unions than originally proposed.
What's good for business is good for New Zealanders. Finally, they've got to have the confidence to invest and to employ. Their bottom lines are being pretty bashed around at the moment. And yet at the end of the day, it's they who will be the ones that prosper from the lower interest rates, from the better employment laws, from a government that's living within their means. We're doing this, finally, for business confidence and for jobs.
This is where we're going. This is step one, this is step two, this is step three. You don't need to think. Got it all mapped out, and we'll get to here. And so she had the whole path mixed and marked, and everybody said, great, fine, let's go.
The new government's first New Year's honours awarded Douglas Myers, chairman of the Business Roundtable, a CBE. Roger Douglas was made a Knight Bachelor.
I don't believe that there are any perceptible differences. The approach was the same. The key elements were the same. Hijack, ambush, speed. Before they've got a chance to think, move on to something else, whilst ensuring that the announced package sees completion.
Education is a key investment in our economic future. The government is determined to provide an environment that enables businesses and individuals to develop internationally competitive and innovative skills.
Fees for tertiary education were increased. Most students had to take out loans.
It's for education, there's a hitch!
Now it's only for the rich!
Now it's only for the rich!
Every New Zealander has a responsibility to stand up for what's right, and what's right is a decent education for a decent society.
I think the more limited objectives have been to bring about user pays in education, while their longer-term agenda has been to move more towards privatisation in education, which might not be total. But certainly, with what they've done with bulk funding of universities, they're wanting to bring that about in schools. And, you know, the user pays side of it is, I think, moving more towards an Americanised sort of education system.
The students continued their protests, but with no effect. Government funding to polytechs and universities was squeezed.
So far, I don't think the opposition has been very successful, and I think if it continues as it has been over the last 4 or 5 years, it won't actually be very successful. I think until we actually start getting unions, student associations working together and mobilising their membership and giving genuine leadership in a struggle opposed to the government policies, then we won't actually be successful. But that doesn't say we can't be successful if those things happen.
When the financial crisis was first revealed, Minister of Health Simon Upton appointed a task force to come up with a plan to overhaul public health services.
Dr. Peter Roberts, Coalition for Public Health.
The task force was led by a banker, and included in the group was a lady from Treasury who's very interested in health economics. And in particular, she believes very strongly in the market model of delivery. They moved very quickly in the direction of major changes in the healthcare system. But none of us were told of this. It was all done in secret. It was done behind closed doors. And it was done with a very narrow ideological group of advisors.
The government has concluded that major changes are needed to create a new health system that is effective and flexible in the delivery of healthcare services to the community.
The elected boards which had run public hospitals were replaced by government-appointed business people. Patients would be charged for their health services. a community card entitled poor people to a government subsidy when they went to the doctor or to hospital.
It's not a question of whether or not this is what New Zealanders want. It's not a question of whether or not this is the way New Zealanders see themselves, because the initial public relations advice that they had said very clearly that a great many New Zealanders believed in the healthcare system that they had.
Overseeing the change to the new regime was Ron Trotter, ex-chairman of the Business Roundtable, head of Fletcher Challenge. A well-known television journalist was recruited to front an advertising campaign.
This unused operating theatre has been here for 8 years, but it's not just unused today. The fact is, it's never been used. It's just one example of why our current health system had to change. The aim is to reduce administration costs, wastage and duplication of services. This is the tiny South Island town of Lawrence.
The public seemed unconvinced, but the changes continued anyway.
Think about your health service and what it means to you and what it will mean in the future. You're only going to end up paying more and more, and the system won't be cost effective. It's been proven not to work in other countries.
Some charges were reduced, but the user pays framework remained.
So the process is intact. Everything is quite capable of moving towards a private healthcare system, similar to what is the primary source of the management of the healthcare system in the United States.
As government expenditure was tightened, private health insurance boomed. Public hospitals sold advertising space on their buildings, and American multinational hospital corporations came looking for investment opportunities. The national government completed most asset sales begun by Labour, but retained the housing corporation, Electricorp, and the railway system. But soon that, including the rail ferries, was sold to an American company and Fay Richwhite.
David Richwhite from Fay Richwhite.
I think everybody stands to gain. It's one of those transactions that I really think is a win-win-win. It was win for the New Zealand public when the Crown sold New Zealand Rail. I'd like to think, like every other good transaction, it's a win for the new owners. But in the long run, the New Zealand public will benefit from an improved railway network and operation.
With most national assets sold, attention turned to the investments built up by regional and local body ratepayers.
The people of Auckland, and I think of New Zealand as a whole, have felt deeply betrayed by the process of privatisation. And it's an emotional thing as much as a rational thing, and there's nothing wrong with it being an emotional thing. People think that over generations we've built up assets in this region, and nationally too, which are ours, our taxes, our work, our effort.
In Auckland, the plan was to privatise the port. The government passed legislation putting the sale in the hands of the Auckland Regional Council.
Any decision to sell any part of the Port of Auckland is in the hands of the people of Auckland. It is not being forced by the government.
Soon, Aucklanders voiced their opposition.
Sovereignty, what does that mean in our country?
You tell me.
I think it means hanging on to assets that, if they're that attractive to foreign investors, why don't we make the most of them?
They have no great understanding of the deep effect of these policies on the Maori people.
33,000 written protests came into the Auckland Regional Council.
What right have they got to sell accumulated public assets to get themselves off the hook?
It doesn't belong to the Regional Council or this government. It's a property of the people of Auckland, who built that port and worked hard to see it the success that it is today.
The Regional Council voted against privatisation. The country's largest port remained in public ownership. In local elections, the newly formed Alliance Party won a majority on the Regional Assets Trust.
The government itself has kept out of it. And I think they just didn't want to fight. They'd set this thing up. It hadn't worked out the way they wanted. It was meant to sell these assets, and you know, got a majority elected who wouldn't do it.
Auckland's port, bus company, rubbish trucks, water and sewage system remained in public ownership. But other communities lost their assets. In Wellington, council management put up proposals to contract out and privatise many council services.
Hazel Armstrong of Wellington City Council.
The public, you know, overall, if you poll them, they oppose privatisation. And they diligently come to the annual plan meetings, they write submissions, they fill out petitions, they lobby their councillors. But what happens is that when the councillors sit around the table, they say, we've been elected to give leadership. Now, what we'll take into account what you have to say, but it's not going to be decisive. I finally, the councillor, will make the decision. So by this kind of, I would say, a distorted view of representation, the councillors believe that they can vote with impunity the way that they want. So in other words, the councillors don't represent their constituents. They become a special elite once they're around the table.
The buses were sold to a Scottish-based multinational, Stagecoach. The power network was partially sold into Canadian control, and the sewage treatment system contracted out to an English company.
And we as a new government have these two task forces, one looking at foreign investment in New Zealand. Are there hurdles, are there bureaucratic blockages that we ought not to have? And the other task force is looking at how we can make New Zealand more attractive to international investors by our promotion efforts.
1990s computer graphics, most of all lots of smiling business people shaking hands.
Aotearoa, New Zealand. Behind the veil of South Pacific beauty is an expanding economy, well prepared for the 21st century. Now highly competitive after a decade of reforms, New Zealand invites international partners to share in an exciting business future. Supportive government policies provide a commercially transparent environment with no hidden costs. There are low interest rates and inflation restrained by law. A freely convertible currency with no restrictions on transfers. Equitable taxation without levies on capital gains. New Zealand, the profitable partner. By 1993, most banks and insurance companies were owned and controlled overseas. The whole telecommunications sector was in the hands of foreign multinationals. Foreign ownership of manufacturing had increased. The forestry sector was almost entirely controlled by multinationals. Foreign holdings on the New Zealand Stock Exchange had increased from 14% in 1984 to almost 50% by 1992, and the half dozen companies which could have been described as New Zealand multinationals, like Brierley's, Lion Nathan and Fletcher Challenge, were now classed as foreign owned.
Not only, Richard mentioned that you've been strengthened by us joining you, but I think we've been strengthened by having you joining us. And I'm really looking forward to the relationship, and welcome to the Irwin family.
For ordinary New Zealanders, the possibilities for opposing New Right policies seemed exhausted. Demonstrations, petitions, opinion polls were ignored. Trade unions had been defeated. Rank and file members of the Labour and National parties felt they had little influence on their parliamentary leaders. Democratic structures like hospital, harbour and power boards had been abolished. City councils were under pressure to sell off assets and privatise services. Democracy in New Zealand had been limited and redefined.
Tony Simpson, historian.
Some individuals in the corporate business sector have been considerably empowered by the events of the last 10 years. But I would guess that 90% of the population of New Zealand has been thoroughly disempowered compared to the influence and effect that they could have on their economy as it impacted on their daily lives in previous decades. We ran what was essentially an insulated economy. We did that for very good reasons. It was one of the instruments we used to achieve control over our lives and to achieve the sorts of social ambitions that most New Zealanders wanted. Some of the options we used may or may not be any longer available for one reason or another, but many of them are. We've simply abandoned them for ideological reasons. One of the consequences of that, of course, has been the thorough interpenetration of the New Zealand economy by large transnational corporations. Many New Zealanders will find, as a result of that, of course, that it will become increasingly difficult to achieve their social ambitions because they will have no means of controlling those organisations, and those organisations, of course, have no interest in the social infrastructure of New Zealand. Probably many of their boards of directors are not even entirely sure where New Zealand is, so why should they give diddly squat about it otherwise than as a set of sub-accounts to a large transnational corporation?
The new right owed a large part of its success to an electoral system which always gave either National or Labour a clear majority. Frequently called an elected dictatorship, first past the post had given key ministers the control they needed to introduce their reforms.
No symbolism in the fact that it's Guy Fawkes Day that we meet.
We've had it up to here with your two-party stuff. You're selling pretty. Well, we go down the drain. Let's have him in, please. So our votes are not in vain. Thank you.
In 1992 and 1993, there were two referendums on the electoral system. In the first, voters chose between first past the post and a range of proportional representation systems. In the second referendum, the choice was between first past the post and the preferred alternative.
Michael Laws, National Party MP.
And they thought, no, well, let's go that. Don't be ridiculous. You know, we'll throw them a bone of a referendum. And the 1992 referendum to decide which was going to be the policy option came as a huge shock. Huge. Shook this place. This place was traumatised for about a week, actually, coming back here and seeing, my God, they hate us. You know, they hate the system. They're voting for reform.
Only 15% supported the existing first-past-the-post system. The second referendum would be held at the same time as the next general election, November 1993.
Look out for your referendum 93 pamphlet.
You'll find it with your community newspaper.
It tells you what you need to know about the two options.
First-past-the-post?
Or MMP. It could be the most important political decision we ever make.
A number of members of Parliament, Helen Clark, Labour leader, Tony Ryle of the Electoral Law Select Committee, Doug Graham and those got together and said, hey, you know, how can we stop this? And then suddenly realised that it looked really bad for these traditional enemies to conspire to try and frustrate public will.
Dana Glendinning of the Electoral Reform Commission.
Up until April 93, you know, really the ERC, Electoral Reform Coalition, had really had it to ourselves, and we were on a roll, you know, to win. And then suddenly in April 93, Peter Shurtcliffe launches his newspaper advertisements.
At the end of the day, the first-past-the-post system has in recent years finally delivered. It's bailed us out of the hole we dug for ourselves 20 or 30 years ago, and we are now one of the best performing economies in the Western world.
You say the economy would go down the gurgler if we got MMP?
It would put enormous stresses and strains and put the achievements of the last 4 or 5 years at risk without question.
Okay, Steve Murray, is that true?
Peter Shurtcliffe set up a campaign office through which the business community could fund major advertising to oppose MMP.
We believe voting for MMP is gambling with our country's future. Our children could pay the price. Is it a risk we can afford? Tick the top box. Reject MMP.
The Electoral Reform Coalition, on the other hand, had a vast body of people and built up networks of activists through allied organisations and sort of spread that network out so that you know, we found people in every little, in places like Kākaka and Kaikoura and Lumsden, and, you know, we thought, who knows who, and educated them about what MMP was about.
Rod Donald of the Electoral Reform Commission.
What we're wanting is a system where every vote counts equally, and that pressure groups can't go and
tap on the shoulder of their favourite cabinet minister and get what they want. And that's what they stand to lose with MMP.
But what's fairer and simpler than one person, one vote?
What is fairer and simpler is one person with a vote that counts no matter where they live, and parties getting seats in Parliament in proportion to their level of support throughout the community. That's the difference.
In the last week before the referendum, Peter Shurtcliffe's campaign spent more on advertising than the Labour and National parties together.
21 extra MPs will cost us millions of dollars every year. Enough is enough. Tick the top box. Reject MMP.
Saturation advertising seemed to be shifting undecided voters against MMP.
Since May, support for the present system has climbed to 41% last weekend. Support for MMP has remained static throughout October on 46%. The undecided are down to 12%.
It was sort of frantic as we sort of juggled with what could we afford and what else could we do.
Election day produced a good turnout. This was expected to favour MMP.
Just put a tick in either of these circles, and one tick on that page.
In the general election, the choice was between National and Labour, with maybe two or three seats going to third parties.
Support for MMP nationwide, we've been tracking this all night. There you see it. 53.8% on a vote count of 91%. So 91%, and you see that Rod Donald there, who we've talked to two or three times tonight, is cutting the MMP cake. He can well afford to do so with 91% of the vote counted at this stage. We have gone for MMP, and we have gone for MMP comprehensively. We have a new system of voting.
I think the tremendous result tonight, of course, is MMP, because the history of this country... they flung everything at it, and the people said no.
And the National Government and the Labour Party will have to get their head around the fact that they no longer own Parliament, the people own it. And that's going to make a big difference.
National lost its huge majority, and the minor parties held four seats and the balance of power.
What New Zealand very, very much needs now is stability, so that those who are interested in New Zealand, whether they be existing investors or potential investors, do not take fright. That's in everybody's interest, no matter who they voted for across New Zealand today.
Next morning, Treasury officials arrived at work early and began shredding documents. They needn't have bothered. Within a few days, the National Government had re-established a working majority. For the time being, the interests of international investors and multinational corporations would continue to reshape New Zealand society.
And is that with people's support? No. Is that against people's strong opposition? Well, not vocalised. 93% of people were against privatising the New Zealand phone company, but they were told that it was inevitable. Is there a limit to what people will put up with? I just need to look at history to see that up to a point, people prefer a quiet life, but there comes a point when people say enough is enough, en masse. Now, to remind us that money is not as fixed and clear-cut as some would like to present it, we return for a brief thought from David Graeber.
The absolute nature of the master's power, the fact that in this context he effectively was the state, also meant that there were also at first no restrictions on manumission, a master could liberate his slave, or even adopt him or her, whereby, since liberty meant nothing outside of membership in a community, that slave automatically became a Roman citizen. This led to some very peculiar arrangements. In the first century AD, for example, it was not uncommon for educated Greeks to have themselves sold into slavery to some wealthy Roman in need of a secretary, entrust the money to a close friend or family member, and then, after a certain interval, buy themselves back, thus obtaining Roman citizenship. This, despite the fact that, during such time as they were slaves, if their owner decided to, say, have one of his secretary's feet cut off, legally, he would have been perfectly free to do so. The relation of dominus and slave thus brought a relation of conquest, of absolute political power, into the household. In fact, it made it the essence of the household. It's important to emphasize that this was not a moral relation on either side. A well-known legal formula, attributed to a Republican lawyer named Quintus Haterius, brings this home with particular clarity. With the Romans, as with the Athenians, for a male to be the object of sexual penetration was considered unbefitting to a citizen. In defending a freedman accused of continuing to provide sexual favours to his former master, Haterius coined an aphorism that was later to become something of a popular dirty joke. Impudicitia in ingenuo crimen est, in servo necessitas, in liberto officium. To be the object of anal penetration is a crime in the freeborn, a necessity for a slave, a duty for a freedman. What is significant here is that sexual subservience is considered the duty only of the freedman. It was not considered the duty of a slave. This is because, again, slavery was not a moral relation. The master could do what he liked. There was nothing the slave could do about it. The most insidious effect of Roman slavery, however, is that through Roman law, it's come to play havoc with our idea of human freedom. The meaning of the Roman word libertas itself changed dramatically over time. As everywhere in the ancient world, to be free meant, first and foremost, not to be a slave, since slavery means, above all, the annihilation of social ties and the ability to form them. Freedom meant the capacity to make and maintain moral commitments to others. The English word free, for instance, is derived from a German root meaning friend, since to be free meant to be able to make friends, to keep promises, to live with a community of equals. This is why freed slaves in Rome became citizens. To be free, by definition, meant to be anchored in a civic community, with all the rights and responsibilities that this entailed.
Compare and contrast that with the sense of the free market, in which individuals are unhampered by social, cultural, or any other non-financial or legal constraints, in which individuals are free to behave with psychopathic disregard for their fellow man. How free does the modern worker feel? Interesting to reflect that the USA, which styles itself the land of the free, locks up a larger proportion of its citizens than any other country in the world. We're looking for material on wage slavery, so if you have some suitable audio or video on that, you're free to drop me an email at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. You're free to download this episode or any of our previous shows as MP3 files from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.